theme of the morning is data collection and quantitative analysis that we have talked about, and we'll continue with that theme now and tell you how we begin to use the data. As you'll see, we'll progress very nicely from the quantitative to the qualitative. So keeping with the quantitative, we'll have Andrew Wong tell us about research applications of the data.
On a previous panel, we heard about a integrated or comprehensive approach to data collection, and here I will talk a little bit about some research applications of the data. At EAO, in addition to working with external contractors in doing data collection, we've also made efforts to be working with external parties in producing the research findings from these. So I want to give two examples illustrative of how we made use of some of the data we collected. A number of the comments that just came up, you know, indicated, you know, thinking about different pieces of the data collection. And, you know, in the survey instrument that we saw earlier that Jennifer O'Brien put up, though we didn't have time to look at all the elements of it, you'll find that we were collecting information on key personnel or on papers that are coming out of the research project. And you heard about Ted talk about the patents data that we were collecting, coming through the survey instruments as well as coming through administrative sources and other sources and integrating it, checking it, and cleaning it up. Earlier we had a comment about what if the company is not patenting the inventions or the intellectual property and pursuing a trade secret strategy. So in the survey instruments, we were also asking for things like the ultimate commercial impacts, the early revenues and cost savings. So we recognize that in looking for the outputs from a research project, there's a whole range of things that may be coming out of it. And, for example, you know, the comment we had over there earlier about sometimes, you know, if you can't, you need the multiple sources because they help, you know, link to each other. If you cannot get all the patents reported by the respondent, if you have names of the key personnel on those projects, or you have the names of the papers that were authored, it gives you another avenue to take those names and match the external databases, and as was suggested earlier, in a sleuthing kind of process or in a database matching process. So, you know, I guess what I want to suggest is that, you know, in that overall survey and database infrastructure integration effort, there's a whole range of things that we were trying to do. And here, in terms of the research application of the data, I just want to use two areas to describe what we did some work with external researchers and used a study as an example. The first area is the use of patents as a measure of R&D output. We'll talk a little bit about that. And the second area is the use of the survey data an example where we use the survey data to assess the R&D alliances. In terms of use of patents, we want to think about ATP funded a research project. NSF may fund research projects. We need to think about what will come out of this thing. At one level, it's knowledge creation. It's knowledge production. So we learned something, okay, and this knowledge is in the heads of people, and it's human capital, and people learn something, and that has a benefit. But what do we measure? You know, what kind of an artifact can we try to measure? So the two most obvious things that usually comes up is, you know, you can measure papers. Papers that researchers write, or you might be measuring patents. Depending on whether you're a university or a corporation, your propensity, your likelihood to either write a paper or publish a paper, or patent something depends on a whole range of factors. But in terms of indicators of research output, these are the things that we might be trying to measure. Just to mention, you know, what is a patent, you know, what is that measuring? You know, Steve mentioned that earlier on that in some of our surveys we were going after invention disclosures in companies. A patent, simply put, would be a measure of an invention, whether at a small company or large company. But more than that, it's a legal claim, a legal right. So oftentimes the concern about trying to measure knowledge, there's no paper trail. Well, patents and papers are, in a sense, are a paper trail for that. So an invention is that's patented has commercial application, that someone saw enough value or potential value to the invention that they're going to take the time and the money to go file an application for it, and in return, they get a monopoly from the government, a monopoly right to use that invention to sell that invention. So, for example, you know, if you're an inventor of a styrofoam cup, when you get a patent on it, there's a legal definition of how your invention is different from other people's stuff. And then once you have that legal claim, then you're the only person who can sell, produce, or market the styrofoam cup. Again, we you know, one of the issues that was mentioned earlier is this propensity to patent. You know, different industries and different organizations have different, you know, propensities to patent. But recognizing that, we know from, you know, a literature on patents that the propensities by industry or by technology may be different, but it is one indicator that we can measure. In terms of patents, you know, initially the effort was to measure the number of patents, but it turns out that not all patents are created equal, that some patents are more valuable than others. And that's where they're building on counting patents. There's an effort to measure the quality of patents, and that most often is done through citation analysis. You see in subsequent years, you know, which patents get more citations. And those patents that are highly cited, it's been demonstrated in a number of studies, are more valuable. And in terms of an independent measure of value, people have looked at, for example, royalties that accrue to certain patents. And so there are some independent measures of the that highly cited patents are higher quality or more valuable patents. Again, in terms of you know, the data collection effort, we have administrative data sources through project management and grants management, and then through surveys we can ask, you know, how many patents have you applied for coming out of the project. And in that case, you know, through survey instruments, we can get earlier information before patent applications are published. But we're also able to ask certain things that are more subjective as to which patent applications do you, the research team, see as the more important ones, or, you know, various subjective measures about the patent. Finally, there's archival data. There are, you know, vendors that provide data, archival databases of patent data. So, in terms of constructing patent measures, some of the things that we need to think about is if you look at the project that you funded, our survey instruments or our administrative data collection can get at what patents the researchers attribute to this project, which ones they're going to attribute or cite, you know, as being coming from this project, the attribution or reporting the government interest. But beyond that, we have thought about that in some cases, a single research project may have a wider effect on the research line of research or the research portfolio or a wider impact on the company. So in the, you know, literature looking at innovation, oftentimes we talk about knowledge spillovers and or behavioral effects that move the larger group beyond the project to take on higher risk research or to move into new emerging fields. So the other approach is to come from the firm level and match data at the firm level from archival sources. So, for example, if we funded IBM, on a specific project, through the survey instrument, you could find out which patents they attribute from that project. At the same time, we can go into archival data sources and match IBM and all the patents they've captured in a given year. We can try to narrow it down to, okay, patents that they applied for in certain technology areas or coming out of certain research locations. So we did have this idea of the research project may be like a pebble that you drop on the pond, and you want to measure that immediate impact from that research project, but there's also a ripple effect that comes out across the lake. So that's where you may take a different top-down approach from another direction to start measuring what patents were coming out of the company or the location. So in terms of doing patent analysis, I just want to suggest, you know, some of the things that we were thinking about. In terms of industry and technology field, again, there are different trends and different propensities to patent in different industries, and a lot of times, if you look at the patents coming out of your research project, you have no absolute way to assess the importance of that. So you need to have a control group or a benchmark or something to compare it to. So within an industry or within a technology class, if you had a benchmark that all patents in this field, the average is such and such, then when you look at your research project, you can see what how it compares to the benchmark. So here I want to talk about, just as an example, one study that we did with external people, Michael Darby and Lynn Zucker at UCLA, and I participated in this project. And here we were looking at ATP project structure and its effects on patenting. ATP funded some projects that were joint ventures, research joint ventures that involved more than one company and oftentimes other nonprofits and universities. The other aspect of project structure to look at whether there was university participation. Using archival data, we matched firms that ATP had funded during the 1990 to 1995 period, projects from 90 to 95, and created and matched it to a patent data set that included patents for all firms from 88 to 99. One thing to keep in mind was that, again, when you look at the unit of analysis, you could be looking at the firm's patenting or you could be looking at the firm in a project. A firm project as a unit of analysis, looking at before and after. An IBM on this project versus IBM who may, IBM may have received many ATP projects. In this analysis, we were looking at unique firms that may have participated in different ATP projects at different points. In terms of looking at, once we match up the firm, construct the firm level data on the patenting, one of the issues, you know, to recognize is that there are population-wide trends that in the 90s, the propensity of patenting in American corporations went up in general. The number of patents went up because, for example, the number of PTO examiners changed and the courts, and there are a lot of things. So, again, there are a lot of technical issues about how you detrend these type of either industry or technology kind of effects. In any case, what we ended up with was a panel data of between 250 to 350 firms over this about a 9-year period, looking at their overall patenting at the company level. The idea is to look at a before and after comparison, before and after they participated in ATP projects, or if they participated in multiple projects, to see which years they were participating in ATP projects as a, you might say, a treatment effect. And, again, as a technical thing, what happens is, you know, if you know that they were participating in your program in, let's say, 1990, then years later you have to wait for sufficient time for any patents that might have come out, you know, to go by. So that's where usually a patent, you know, may take 2 to 3 years to come out. So in this case, we had patent data that ran all the way through 99, but our analysis sample ends in 96. So if someone was on a research project in 96, presumably by 99 some of their patents would have come out. This is what's described as a truncation problem. But here, in the end, what we did is a certain regression analysis that looked at ATP projects. ATP companies that were funded by ATP on different projects, looked at the years that they participated in these ATP projects and then looked at patents from those firms in those years that they participated in APP projects. In a regression analysis, there were various controls for firm size or the technology field. And the general conclusion coming out of this was that ATP project participation appears to have increased firm patenting from 4 to 25%, depending on the type of firm or project, and that joint venture and university participation have an effect, a positive effect on patenting outcomes.
Was the distribution even between 4 and 25, or were they mostly skewed to 4% or mostly skewed to 25%?
I don't know the specifics on that, but what happens is that, in, you know, like small firms and large firms may have very different, you know, impact measures. We don't expect to have much of a, you know, impact on a large firm. The other thing is that this is, you know, in different regression analyses, there's a range of estimates that emerge, and so we don't want to rely, you know, that much on the specific number, but you know, we have some finding that there is some positive effect of project participation.
You may say that, but I would argue 4% is meaningless, 25% is very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
right.
Where it falls makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Right. Point accepted. The other application that I want to talk about is using the survey data, and we've described a number of you know, survey questions, and in this case, working with Jeff Dyer at Brigham Young and others, we used ATP data on research joint ventures to look at what factors influence the success of R&D alliances in generating innovation. And in setting up the analysis, we considered two classes of factors, one that we might call the alliance formation factors, that at the time of alliance creation, these projects came to us, they got together and proposed a project to us, and the number of partners, the type of partners, for example, whether it includes a competitor or whether it includes customers, the geographic proximity of the different partners, these are some of the kind of structural attributes of a research alliance. There are other characteristics that we would consider the partner attributes. For example, whether the company has had prior experience in R&D alliances, either in general or with the specific, R&D alliance partners in this project, have they worked together before? Does prior experience working together increase the chances that you're going to do well this time? As well as attributes such as your R&D capability, looking at the amount of R&D expenditures you do in the year, a sense of your research lab size. So these are some of the, at time of creation of the alliance, design factors. The other set of factors that we were looking at, we described as alliance execution factors, or you might say these are more like management variables. It's like once this project is underway, what are things that project management might be able to address? And here, commitment of technical personnel or human capital to the resources. Oftentimes managers are concerned that when you're in a research joint venture, you know, is my partner putting their best guy on the project, or you know, is there free riding? So, looking at measures of how much technical person, how many, you know, technical resources you're committing to the project, or frequency of communication is a management variable. How do you communicate? How often do you communicate? How often do you meet? Another set of things that we looked at were governance issues. The satisfaction with arrangements for sharing intellectual property, on allocating, you know, who gets the intellectual property coming out of it, dispute resolution mechanisms, work task monitoring, how do we know that, you know, each person is doing what they're supposed to be doing. These we call, you know, governance characteristics, as well as trust. We had some survey items that were looking at, in effect, Do you trust that your, you know, alliance partner would not take advantage of you even if they had an opportunity to do so? In this survey-based study, we used a number of different types of outcomes measures. It wasn't just one outcomes measure. Again, there are the subjective measures coming off of the survey, these qualitative assessments of project success and value. Did you achieve your technical goals? What kind of intangible, you know, how pleased were you with these intangible outcomes such as learning and contributing to the research effort at your firm? We did use survey-based measures of the number of patent applications that had been reported from the survey instrument, as well as the commercial impact, early revenues or cost savings. In most of our survey instruments, we are asking for realized cost savings or revenues or licensing revenues. We're also, because so often we're looking ahead, we're often also asking about anticipated, you know, your anticipation for in the next 3 years, you know, what kind of commercial impacts you might have. This was using ATP data from joint ventures. There were 397 firms in 142 research joint ventures. And the general findings were that these alliance execution factors are better predictors of success than alliance formation factors. You know, from an equilibrium standpoint, one might imagine that if different companies are putting their own projects together and they all kind of design their projects optimally and they came to us, you know, one approach would be that, well, they've all designed their thing optimally. If two partners is what they need, then that's what they got. If 10 is what they need, then that's what they got. So in effect, we do find that these structural characteristics don't seem to have a difference, and our explanation is they've already self-selected or self-designed. But the management factors turn out to make a difference. What kind of technical personnel you're putting into the project and the communication, the frequency of communication turns out to be very important. In terms of trust or governance, we describe some of these governance issues as contractual trust in that when it comes to intellectual property, knowledge sharing, dispute resolution, task monitoring, performance monitoring, satisfaction or the structures and arrangements for how you manage these things, that matters. The goodwill trust about do you trust, you know, the other company that they wouldn't take advantage of you? Turns out that that doesn't matter. So, or it doesn't matter as much. So it tells us that, maybe this is obvious, but now we have regression analysis to show it, that in a research alliance that the arrangements and the governance procedures or the contracts that you have in place and the satisfaction with those contracts to handle intellectual property and these kind of matters, this has an influence on whether the project turns out to be successful. Whereas this general kind of trust that, you know, you kind of trust the other company does not have as much of a role. And finally, something I think Steve mentioned also is that survey measures of ambitiousness of the project turn out to have an effect on the success of the research alliance. That is, the survey questions ask, you know, how ambitious is this project relative to other projects in the industry? Or what's the technical difficulty of this project? And it turns out that those that are, you know, harder or more ambitious are more successful. And you could interpret this in various ways. You know, one interpretation is that those where there's a challenge, there's a response. For the very challenging projects, it may, you know, engender, you know, greater commitment that the research team is, you know, trying to solve a big challenge, and the amount of organizational and management effort and commitment onto the project is greater. And that would be, you know, one interpretation of that. And I think that's where I end.
Thank you, Andrew.